Great. So we continue with the sixth canto. Now this section of Ajāmi spans over three chapters. And it's a broad division. The pastime of Ajāmi, the story of Ajāmi itself, at the first chapter. The second chapter is primarily the discussions between the Nirguntas and the Vishnuntas. And the deliverance of Ajāmi comes in the second chapter. The third chapter is the discussion between Yamdutas and the discussion between Yamraj and Yamdutas. So now at the end of that pastime, that particular section ends. See the
it's 6:15.
So the Bhagavatam moves on as a largely as a question driven narration. It's like sometimes we have a class, and the class is primarily the speaker driven. The speaker has prepared a particular subject, and based on that, the speaker speaks. But after the speaker has completed the class, then there will be question answers. And then the discussion, the narration will go on largely based on questions. What kind of question is asked? Then based on that, the narration will go on. So the Bhagavatam is largely question driven. So the question, it's question driven means whatever questions Parikshit Maharaj asks, it is Shukadeva Goswami answers according. Now there is of course a theme in the Bhagavatam, and there is a unity overall in the structure and the content of the Bhagavatam. But still, the primary driving impetus is the questions. And these questions shape the narrative of the Bhagavatam. Now, sometimes the questions are also a part of the linear flow of the Bhagavatam, in the sense that, especially in the 10th canto, a particular pastime is happening and then the background of pastime is asked. Or here in the 6th canto also we'll see that when the Chitraketu story is told, or rather Vritrasura story is told, and then the background is asked, and then the Chitraketu pastime comes up. So that is within the story, so it's the connections are relatively easier to understand. But sometimes the connections require the commentaries to understand what question is being asked and how that is connected with what has gone on earlier. Sometimes the question may not be connected, just like if we have a class, the second question is not necessarily related to the first question. The second question will be related to something in the class earlier. And what section of the class that is related with, that will, if somebody is just starting off at that point, they may not really immediately realize that. So like that, let's see what's the question with which the fourth chapter starts. The chapter is called the Hamsa Guhya Prayers. So the prayers with which the Lord is pleased, the secret prayers, and especially the word Hamsa comes in the prayers, and it is the theme of the prayers. Hamsa means a swan. Hamsa is also an avatar of the Lord. Hamsa also is a symbol of purity. Just as the Hamsa can purify, take milk out of water and separate the two, similarly the theme of this prayer, the word Hamsa will come also in the prayer. The theme of these prayers is that one can perceive the pure Lord, the pure consciousness. That Lord who is Guhya, when our consciousness also becomes like a Hamsa, we'll be able to purify it. The Hamsa Guhya can have multiple meanings, but if you look at the prayers themselves have this theme that the Lord, the pure Lord is pursued with the pure consciousness. So, Shri Raja Vacha, Devasurnam Sargo, Naganam Rudapakshinam, Samasikastvaya Prokto, Yastu Swayam Bhuve Antare, Tasyaiva Vyasam Ichhami, Gyantum De Bhagavan Yatha, Anusargam Yaya Shaktya, Sasarja Bhagavan Paraha. So Sasarja Bhagavan Paraha, how did that transcendental Lord create? I wish to know this. Sasarja Anusargam Yaya Shaktya, how he brings about the creation. Sarga Anusarga, Anusarga refers to secondary creation. I wish to know that Yaya Shaktya, by his energy. And also I wish to know something else. What is that? He gives a list of the various beings in the universe, devas, nrinam, sarga, naganam, mrugapakshinam, devatas, asuras, humans, the serpents, the animals, the birds. And so, sarga, during the creation, how all they are manifested? Samasikastvaya prokto. You have described this in samas. Samas means briefly. You have mentioned it briefly. So, like samas is actually like a summary. You have summarized it earlier. Vastu Swayambhuve Antare. All this happened in the Swayambhu Manvantara. So that we have described earlier. So actually, the process of creation has been mentioned in the third canto, how the living beings manifest. And since you mentioned that earlier, I would like to know more about it. Vyasam Ichhami. The word Vyasa literally means editing or editor. So here there is context. Now, editing can involve cutting down things, expanding things. Basically making things more understandable. The editor is the one who acts as a bridge between the writer and the audience to make the writer's message more intelligible for the audience. So like that here, we say, Vyasam Ichhami, I desire to hear it. Please elaborate. Gyantim De Bhagavan Yatha. So Bhagavan again, the Bhagavatam repeatedly uses the word Bhagavan to refer to great persons. So it does not reserve that title only for the Supreme Lord. And I wish to know it all. Oh Bhagavan, oh Sutta Goswami, oh Shukadeva Goswami, is Rajovacha. So now here what happens? There is a, in detail I wish to hear this. So what is happening in the Bhagavatam is that Swayambhu Manu's life is being described. I discussed this at the start of the 6th canto. Mentioned that broadly from the 3rd canto onwards till the 7th canto, it is Swayambhu Manu's life going on. And in Swayambhu Manu's life, first the various descendants, Maharaj Uttanapad, then Dhruva, then his descendants, that line goes down, that all comes in the 4th canto. So some of his daughters, like Devahuti and others, they are described in the 3rd canto, what happens in their life. In the 4th canto, his son is described, Uttanapad, Dhruva, and then in the 5th canto, we have his other son. Who is that? Devrat, yeah. So he's described. And then after that, while describing his accomplishments of how he, you know, moved his chariot across the universe, and his descendants are also described over there, then the universe is described. And then here he's saying that how things move forward in the creation of Swayambhu Manvantara, that is described. So please describe that. So, text 3. Shri Suta Vacha. Iti Samprashnam.
Iti samprashnam akarnya
Rajarshir Badarayane Pratinandya Mahayogi Jagad Munisattamaha Iti samprashnam akarnya. On hearing this prashna, a question, Rajarshir Badarayane, the great sage, Rajarshir Badarayane, he, the great sage who was Badarayana, he spoke. Pratinandya Mahayogi. Pratinandya, he was pleased. He appreciated the question. And that person was the Mahayogi. Jagad, he spoke it. Munisattamaha. Munisattama is referring. Sutta Goswami is referring to those sages. Munisattama, best of sages. He is addressing them respectfully. Shishuka Vacha. Yada Prachetasaha Putra
Dasha Prachina Barhishaha
Andha Samudra Unmagna Tadrushurgandrumaivrutam. So, Prachini Bari was described in the 4th canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam. Now, he had his 10 sons. They had entered the water for performing austerities. And while they were performing austerities, when they came out, Tadrushu, they saw, what did he say? Gam Drumai Vrutam. Gam is the earth, Drumai is trees, Vrutam is covered by. So it's like if we go to a place that is, say, a garden or a place which is in the greenery. And then if that is neglected, then often weeds grow all over and everything, the vegetation overgrows and it becomes disorganized. So like that, the trees had grown very wide. And then what had happened was, The tree, there is an overall balance in the universe. And there are different species and they all have their allotted space. But the nature is, as we will see later in the section, that there is competition. And whenever, say, the king was, so Pachetas, sons, the Pachini Barishas, they basically, the Pachetas, they were rulers. And when they were not ruling, at that time, the kingdom became neglected and the trees overgrew. And here they see, we will see subsequently their anger at the trees. This anger is actually almost like a Kshatriya becoming angry with an invader. So they see the trees as if they have invaded their kingdom and they have taken over their kingdom. And that's how they become angry. So, here what is happening? Now we may first raise a question. What is the correlation between the question and the answer? Isn't it? The question was, I wish to explain how the please describe how the creation took place and how when these living beings were created. So here what he is doing is giving us a backstory that the primary agent from whom many living beings, all the various living beings are manifested, that is Daksha. And how Daksha appeared, they are describing that. So Daksha, he is the son of the Prachetas. So there's a brief story about the Prachetas, and then Daksha's appearance will be described. Daksha's appearance, and then how Daksha creates will be described. Sometimes it can lead to confusion. So usually when the Bhagavatam is, you know, he's not in a Parikshit Maharaj, not in a hurry. So when an answer is given, he can give a backstory also. So quite often, you know, it is said that in question answers, a good strategy while answering questions is, first answer the question, then explain the answer. That means, so for example, say yesterday somebody had asked a question, that can Lord Shiva also give liberation? So now, at that time, if I start feeling this scripture says, and I can go in all that direction, and all that is good, but throughout at the back, there is a possible, so can he grant liberation or can he not grant liberation? Well, that question is always there at the back of the mind. So usually, if we are answering questions, it's good to first answer the question and then explain the answer. If you start explaining the answer without actually giving a specific answer, people, what happens is, they are hearing, but they are not just hearing the argument, they are like, okay, what is the actual answer? So sometimes, the question answers, especially if you don't have much time, then it's good to be terse. Say something?
No.
So that there are situations when this strategy may not work. But I'm saying in general, there are times when a direct answer is not advantageous. And there are times when a direct answer is advantageous. So if it is a matter of chosen strategy, that is perfectly fine. As a matter of strategy, in certain situations, a blunt answer may alienate people. And that time, giving a background and giving the answer is fine. That's a chosen strategy. Sometimes what happens, if we have an answer and we want to think, okay, make this point, that point, that point, and we start trying to build a case for the answer, but in that process, we don't explicitly give the answer. So it is I'm talking about strategies. So if we know the answer, the answer is clear and the answer is not really going to alienate people, it is better to give the answer than explain the answer. But in some cases, as a matter of strategy, if the answer is going to be provocative, it's going to be alienating, then better give a context and then give the answer. So both strategies are there. My point is simply that a strategy should be consciously chosen. It should not be just unconsciously that we start rambling and leave the audience wondering about the answer. So whichever strategy we use, that's perfectly fine. This is not a universal strategy that we should always answer the question and then explain the answer. Okay. So, he's giving this background now. So, fifth text. Rumebhya krudyamanaste tapo deepita manyavaha mukhato vayum agnimcha So, Drumebhya, unto those trees, Krudyamanaste, they became angry with the trees. Tapo deepitamanyavaha. So they are filled with anger. The consciousness, they become filled with anger, and that anger inside manifested as fire from their mouth. Mukhato vayu agnincha. Okay. So vayu and agni, from their mouth they brought it out. So there is this mystic power by which some people can bring out fire from their mouths. Now, it is fire alone is not enough. The fire, if it just stays in the mouth, what does it do? The fire has to go somewhere. So along with the fire, some wind also has to come. So both vayu and agni have come out, and sasrujis tadidakshaya. So when they saw this, now what they had performed, tapo deepitamanyavaha, they had actually performed a lot of austerities. Now it's interesting, the correlation, that quite often an austerity is performed, often there is, what happens is, when we perform austerity, we gain a lot of control over ourselves. Now I may not eat something, or I may not sleep, I may not do this, I may not do that. So in one sense, austerity can be anukul for bhakti, because we can focus our mind, if it is going here and there, and focus on Krishna. But one offshoot of austerity is that when we are able to control ourselves, the controlling mentality often becomes strong. And when something external is not in our control, or something external doesn't go according to our plan, then we blaze up. So that one has to be careful when we perform austerity and gain a lot of self-control. Certainly we need to gain self-control, but the self-control is for surrendering to self-supreme control. Self-control is not to increase our controlling mentality. And quite often that's why we see sages who perform a lot of austerities. They are austere sages, but then, so they often control lust and sexual desire, but they succumb to anger very easily. What's the classic example of this? Durvasamuni. Yeah. He's a renunciate, but then he gets angry over trivial things. So why? Because the austerity has increased the controlling mentality. When controlling mentality increases, when things are not controlled, then one explodes. So here, we will see that this anger at one level is justified. But at another level, the extent of the anger is not justified. And they will be told later to check their anger. But so there, so because of their austerities, they had that controllership, and they felt that we are the kings and we are also meant to take care of the kingdom, and these are encroached on the kingdom. So that anger blazed out as the fire from their mouths. Then what happens? Tabhyam nirdahiyamanam stan.
Tabhyam nirdahiyamanam
stan. Upalabhya kurudvaha.
Upalabhya kurudvaha.
Rajo vache mahan somo.
Rajo vache mahan somo.
Manyum prasham prashammayandiva.
Manyum prashammayandiva.
So, tabhyam. At that time, when they were nirdahiyamanam stan, when they are burning the trees, reducing them to ashes, upalabhya kurudvaha, when he came to know about this, kurudvaha is addressed to Parikshit Maharaj, Rajovacha Mahan Somo. So that person came and spoke. Who is that spoke? That is Somo. He is also a great person. He is the king of the trees, and he is came, Manyun Prashammayaniva. He spoke this to pacify them, to appease their anger. So there are, you know, all of us are subject to our human weaknesses. Whoever we may be, even if we are advanced, still we are all subject to our human weakness. Sometimes we may succumb to lust, sometimes we may succumb to anger. So what is there is, it is not that even an exalted devotee is necessarily entirely free from this. Even if they are entirely free, sometimes in certain circumstances, certain things may get triggered. So Dhruva Maharaj has darshan of the Lord, but even after having darshan of the Lord, and at that time it's not just simply darshan, he's extremely purified. The extent of his purity is that which was his aspiration that had driven his austerity. He says, I don't want that anymore. He had performed all the austerity to get the kingdom, and he said, I don't want the kingdom. So he had indeed become purified. But later, when his brother was killed by the Yakshas, he got angry. And then what happened? So this anger, there are inbuilt checks and balances. So when he got excessively angry, what happened? Now there was another person who came to help him at that time. Who came to guide him? Manu came over there. Manu came and he spoke to him. counseled him and told him to come down. So that is why it is important that we have some trustworthy spiritual association around us. If we are in a position where people are afraid to correct us, or people are afraid to tell us when they feel we are doing something wrong, then we put ourselves in an insecure situation. So, strong relationships, it is not just where, you know, how brightly we smile when we see each other or how tightly we embrace each other. Strong relationships are those relationships that can survive strong speaking. So, one person may speak strongly to another person. So, strong, when somebody speaks strongly, now it's not that it's a virtue to speak strongly. It's not that we make that perversely, I should speak strongly and you should not feel hurt. No, but there are situations when strong speaking is required. And at that time, when strong speaking is required, if somebody gets alienated by that, and somebody just goes away and closes up, then they cannot be helped. So, a strong relationship are those relationships that can survive strong speaking. And we need to have that kind of relationship at least with some devotees. So here, we see that even the great souls get angry, but there are others who check them. They protect them. So that is what the Soma will do now here, in the Prachitas. So, Nadrumebhyo Mahabhaga.
Nadrumebhyo Mahabhaga.
Dinebhyo Drogdhum Arhatha.
Dinebhyo Drogdhum Arhatha.
Vivardhai Shavo Yuyam. Prajanam Patayah Smutaha. So, Nadrumebhyo Mahabhaga, O greatly fortunate ones. So, Nadrumebhyo, don't burn these trees. Dinebhyo Drogdhum Arhatha. Dinebhyo. These are actually trees that are helpless. They cannot even move. They cannot do anything to defend themselves. So, do not burn them. Vivardhya means to grow. So you desire, you yam, all of you, you yam is a plural second person address. Like you is in, you is, we say when you are addressing one person, when we are addressing many people, all of you, we may say. So in English, you yam is plural second person address. So they are addressed, because there are 10 prachetas, they are being addressed over. In Sanskrit, you yam is that address. This is all of you desire to expand the progeny. Prajanam patayasmuta. So you desire to expand the progeny. You are the protector of the citizens. Then how can you destroy these trees? They are helpless. The name. So he's actually evoking their compassion. And Chakravarti Pada explains his commentary that that Soma is very, very angry. The Prachitas are very, very angry. And Soma realizes that just by words it's going to be difficult to control their anger. So the previous verse also said, Eva. You know, Manyu Prashaman Iva. Iva means he spoke words which were meant to pacify. Their anger was so great that words alone could not have pacified. So he uses different strategies. Basically, he uses Sam, Dam, and Bhed. He used for that, and which other verses which talk about Sam, Dam, Bhed, we'll go ahead and we'll see. So Sam, Dam, Bhed means what? Sam means, what is Sam, Dam, Bhed? Sam means calming down, basically, you know, to give good counsel, to allay whatever anger or grievances that are there by good word, by counseling. Basically saying, we all share the same interest, you know, whatever is your concern, my concern also same. So, we are agree. So, Dam is basically giving something to the person. Now, sometimes Dam is thought of as negative, it's not necessarily negative. Sometimes certain people may have certain expectations, and providing those expectations is also a valid strategy. And Bheda means, you know, pointing out, you know, actually that, you know, we can create, it at one level means creating division in the opposite party. But Bheda also means pointing out to the same person, actually you have this interest and you have this interest also. So don't think only this particular course of action will serve your interest. This is also your interest, this is also your interest, and you have to balance both. So basically, if a person has one focus or person is just thinking on one track, then showing that there are different aspects of this issue. You cannot just think on one track. That is also in one sense Bheda. So we'll see how he uses all these strategies. So he goes on. So first thing he's doing Sama, he's giving counsel to show how, to make him make them act in a proper ways. Basically, Sam is calmness, equanimity, and that's what he's trying to get them to calm down. Aho Prajapatir, Patir,
Prajapatir,
Patir, Bhagavan Harir Avyayah,
Bhagavan Harir Avyayah,
Vanaspatim Oshadhishcha,
Vanaspatim Oshadhishcha,
Sasar Jorjam Isham Vibhu,
Sasar Jorjam Isham Vibhu.
So here there is poetic alliteration, Prajapatir Patir. So Prajapati is Daksha and they are going to be the father of Daksha. So in the universal order, a certain people have certain positions. So it's already known that, you know, he's there, the Prachetas are going to be the father of Daksha. So Prajapatir Patir. You are the Pati, the father or the master of the Prajapati. Sorry. Actually Prajapatir Patir here refers to the Supreme Lord. It can refer here to Prachetas also. But here it refers to the Lord who is the Lord of all the progenitors, the Supreme Lord. Aho Prajapatir Patir, Bhagwan Hariravya. That Lord is being described by various words. Avyaya, he is Hari. So here, it is he himself who has created this. Vanaspatir Oshadhishcha. He himself Sasarja. He has only created it. Isham Vibhu. He is the controller. And he has created all this with the fruits and grains. So he is basically giving them a spiritual vision. Don't see these simply as invaders who have pervaded who have occupied your kingdom. They are also authentic citizens in the universal population. And then he annam charanam achara, annam charanam achara, yapadha padacharinam,
yapadha padacharinam,
ahastahastayuktanam,
ahastahastayuktanam,
vipadam cha chatushpadaha,
vipadam cha chatushpadaha.
The verse in the first canto is very similar. Ahastani sahastanam, padani sahpadanam. So similar here it is. Basically, the question here is saying that how there is competition in this world, that annam charanam achara. So achara, that which doesn't move, like the grains and the grass and the shrubs, they are the anna for the charanam, they are for the moving. Then apadaha padacharinam. Similarly, those which don't have food, they are often the food for those which have food. They are there food for those which have food. So asta asta yuktanam. And similarly, those which don't have hands, they are the food for those which have hands. Dvipadam cha chatushpadaha. And similarly, the two-handed are the food for the, so the two-limbed are the food for the four-limbed. So it's interesting, ahasta sa hastanam. So animals without hands are food for animals with hands. Now, which are the animals with hands? Monkeys. So monkeys are usually not considered carnivores. So the point here is that actually this can refer to humans eating animals also. So meat eating is not a recommended course of action, but it is not entirely forbidden. Meat eating is, what Prabhupada has given us is not just Vedic culture, he's given the best of Vedic culture. Best of Vedic culture means it's largely a Brahminical standard. So the Kshatriyas would hunt, and often after hunting they would eat the meat. There are some Kshatriyas who would not eat, for Prabhupada says in the first canto that Rantidev was a Kshatriya, but he never ate meat. So the point is that the Vedic culture was pragmatic. Pragmatic means that if Kshatriyas are going on a long journey, and then they're fighting and they're going to, they have to travel at high speeds. At that time, they cannot carry huge quantity of grains. Grains also have to be cooked elaborately. So at that time, if they just eat fruits and shrubs, they don't get enough strength. So at times during aggression, Kshatriyas are allowed to eat meat. It is not a recommended course of action, but it is a sanctioned course of action. And those who are in Sattva Guna, they don't eat meat. And if you see, even from the anatomy point of view, from the human anatomy, our body is not suited for meat eating. But it is not utterly incapable of meat eating. We also have some teeth which are called canine teeth, with which we can, they are sharper teeth, and with which we can cut sharper. So now the problem is The problem is two things. That meat was a part of the human diet, but it was never a prominent part of the human diet. Human beings, we are not really capable of. Nowadays, people eat meat morning, afternoon, evening. You know, meat is a day. Many people can't even conceive of food, especially in the Western world. They can't conceive of food without meat. That has become a staple food, and that was never the case. It is an occasional food, even for people who are living in the forests and people who are hunters. But it's not that they would eat only the hunted animal. They would also eat fruits and other things. But one problem is that there is the excessive quantity of meat. Meat can be a small part of the diet for some people when it is necessary, but when it is a major part of the diet, a regular part of diet, a daily part of diet, that becomes a problem. And further, it was in the past there were never organized slaughterhouses where not only animal butchers were there who would kill animals. But organized slaughterhouses means that the natural order is totally disrupted, because in the slaughterhouses, not just we consider slaughterhouses places where animals are killed, but actually now what is there in the world is not just slaughterhouses, there are animal farms. Animal farms means the animals are grown over there exclusively for the purpose of slaughtering. And the conditions there are very brutal, unnatural and very horrible. So hundreds of animals are sometimes crammed in a small place, and it's organized brutality. It's organized brutality and excessive eating of meat. These are very strongly condemned. But sometimes, even Prabhupada was open about that. You know, when Narikesh Prabhu told that if I go to the Soviet bloc, there is no vegetarian food allowed. So Prabhupada said, eat meat but preach. So Prabhupada certainly did not encourage meat eating. But the point is that it was meat eating is a fact in human civilization. But the excessive proportion of the meat and the organized brutality that goes into animal farming, that is what is strongly condemned. So now why is he talking about this? There are different living beings, are food for different living beings. The point is that the prachetas may argue that they are also citizens of the universe, but why are they encroached? Why are they encroached on the king, the whole kingdom? So the point they are making is that actually there is always this competition, and whenever anyone gets an upper hand, they will take the upper hand. So the trees, there is nobody to regulate them, so they overgrow, and that's how they are spread everywhere now. Yuyam cha pitran vadishta,
yuyam cha pitran vadishta,
deva devena chanagha,
deva devena chanagha,
praja sargaya hi katham,
praja sargaya hi katham,
vikshan nirdagdhum arhata,
vikshan nirdagdhum
arhata. All of you, pitran vadishta, by the order of your father, pitran, deva deve na chanagha, and not only the father but even deva deva, the supreme lord has ordered you are sinless. The praja sargaya, he has ordered you to expand the population, and then vrukshanigdagdum arhata, then how can you kill the trees? So one point is, again for the previous verse, you talk about the cycle of the biosphere. Another point is that actually the trees are required to sustain other living beings. Even if you say that you have to create ajar praja, the other praja is also going to need the trees, because there is a interconnected chain of being where all living beings depend on each other. So if you destroy the trees, how will you fulfill your duty of expanding the population? Then he further says,
Atishthat satam margam,
kopam yachaddipitam, pitra pitamahenapi,
yushtam vah prapitamahe.
So, satam margam, the path of the righteous, the true path which is followed earlier, atishtata, follow it. And who is following? Your father, grandfather, great-great-grandfather, all of them have followed this path. And what was that path? They acted according to dharma. They did not give up dharma because of any emotion. So, this kopam yachaddipitam, give up your anger. So here is all the part of the counsel you're giving, that actually you should act in a way that behooves your dynasty. The members of a great dynasty, so act in a proper way. Further, Tokanam Pitarau Bandhu,
Tokanam Pitarau Bandhu,
Drushaha Pakshmastriya Patihi,
Drushaha
Pakshmastriya Patihi, Patihi Prajanam Vikshunam,
Patihi Prajanam Vikshunam,
Gruhiya Agyanam Budhasurut,
Gruhiya Agyanam
Budhasurut. So here, an example, multiple examples are given of how one living being is meant to protect others, or especially those who are in a leading position, they are meant to protect others. So, Tokanam Pitarau Bandhu. So, Pitarau Bandhu, that the parents protect their family, their children, their family members, children. Drushaha Pakshma. So, the eyelids protect the eye. If nobody has to tell the eyelids to do their duty. As soon as some danger comes, the eyelids automatically blink and they protect the eye. So, Striya Pati, the husband protects the wife. Pati Prajanam. So, the Prajanam, Bhikshunam. So, Pati here refers to, the second Pati refers to actually the householder. Prajanam Bhikshunam, the people who are renunciates, the householders are meant to maintain the renunciates. Gruhya Agyanam Budhasurut. Agyanam Budhaha. So, those who are ignorant, they are meant to be protected by the wise. That means, if the ignorant people don't know what to do, they are to be guided by the wise people who have the knowledge of what to do. So in this way, there are different people who have some power, some ability. They are meant to protect others. So, okay, so how it is? Chakravarti Padak says, Sthriyapati and Prajanampati. So actually, they are being told, so Sthriyapati refers to the husband of the wife who is supposed to protect. Pati Prajanam refers to the king who is supposed to protect the citizens. And Bhikshunam Gruhiya. So that they are told, you are the king who have to protect the citizens. And for that, they are given four other examples. So Pitarau Bandhu, Drushaha Pakshma, Sthriyapati. Actually five examples, Bhikshunam Gruhiya and Agyanam Budhaha. So in this way, you are meant to protect them. Antardeheshu Bhutanam,
Antardeheshu Bhutanam,
Atmaste Haririshvaraha,
Atmaste Haririshvaraha,
Sarvam Tadhishnam Ikshadvam,
Sarvam Tadhishnam Ikshadvam,
Evam Vastoshito Yasau,
Evam Vastoshito Yasau.
So, Antardeheshu Bhutanam, I mean all living beings, see that Atmaste Haririshvara, the super soul is situated in all living beings. Sarvam tan dishyam ikshadvam. All living beings are his abode. See things in this way. Don't see the trees as intruders. So now there are different levels of vision. First is, the trees are creations of the Supreme Lord. Second is, the trees are also citizens of the universal population. The trees are maintained, trees are required for you to do your duty. If you create praja, the trees are required for the maintenance of the praja also. And now, there are higher and higher levels of vision given. The trees are also the abode of the Supreme Lord. Supreme Lord is present over there. And when you see like this, then evam vas toshitoya. So in this way, the Lord will become satisfied. Haritoshanam we have. So toshita. Toshita means to satisfy, to please. In this way, you will be able to please them. Yaha samutpatitam deha.
Yaha samutpatitam deha.
Okay. Yeah. Akashan manyum ulbanam.
Akashan manyum ulbanam.
Atmajikyasayat yachche.
Atmajikyasayat yachche.
Sagunanati vartate. So, now Chakravarti Pada said, he's talking about the Bheda. So, he's talking about Sam till now, giving all this, how you should see the trees. Now, he says that, somebody says, but the anger is coming inside me. When the anger comes, how can just somebody control? So, he says, see that this anger inside is you is not you. It is coming from the modes. So you are a person. One of the important things for us to resist temptation is to not identify with the temptation. Now, if somebody comes and tells us, say if we want to eat a regulated diet, and somebody come on, let's have a feast. You say, no, I won't have a feast. But the same desire comes from inside. Come on, let me go and eat. We say, yes, I'll go and eat. What happens is, that desire which comes from inside, we assume it to be me. Whatever is inside me, we assume it to be me. But here, he's saying that if you can see that whatever is inside you is not necessarily you, then you can go beyond the modes. So, gunan ativartate, you will go transcend the modes. That means the modes are producing this. Yasamutpatitam deha akashan manyumulvanam. So, samutpatitam deha, in the body, when suddenly anger arises, at that time what should one do? Atma jigyasaya yachet. Atma jigyasaya refers to inquiring about spiritual reality. When it arises suddenly, now here akashan manni ulbanam. Ulbanam means like a comet or a asteroid which suddenly appears in the sky. So sometimes anger comes like a bolt out of the blue. Where does it come from? At one moment the person is calm, and other moment, next moment the person is blazing in anger, shouting irrationally. Sometimes when anger comes like that, how do we control that? Say, see that this actually, if we meditate on the Supreme Lord, then that checks the force of the anger on us, and that reminds us of spiritual wisdom. Dhamma Vidhi Yogam. Okay, see, actually this anger is inside me, but it is not my anger. It's something which is externally coming within. So he's saying that don't see this as your desire that is being thwarted. You say, I am angry and I am expressing my anger. Rather, think that actually this anger is something which has come from outside into you and that is controlling you. So create that bhed within yourself. So when, as long as we think this is my desire, then to resist the desire, it seems like suppression. But when we see that it is not my desire, then to resist it is actually a victory. Now, this is something external that has come into me and it is controlling me. Then, no, I won't let it control myself. So that means the key to resisting desire is resisting the identification with the desire. As soon as I identify with the desire, then I will feel as if, oh, I am suppressing myself by not indulging in this. Why should I suppress myself? But if I can avoid identifying with the desire, then what happens? Then I see that actually this desire is controlling me. This desire is conquering me. And it becomes like, I want to protect my consciousness. So rather than we seeing it as suppression, we see it as protection. We see it as protecting our own consciousness, protecting our territory, our consciousness territory, from getting overcome by temptation. So here, he says, in this way, see that this anger is not your anger and resist it. And now in the last verse, Soma will also use Dhamma. Sama Bheda Dhamma. Dhamma is, well, let's see what it is. Alam Dagdhair Drumai Dinai Alam Dagdhair Drumai Dinai Khilanam Shivamastuvaha Shivamastuvaha Varkshiya Eshavara Kanya Varkshiya Eshavara Kanya Patnitve Pratigruhiyatam Patnitve Pratigruhiyatam. So Alam Dagdhai Drumai Dinai. So okay, now the trees have been burned, enough about it, alam, I don't need to talk more about it, what has been done, they are burned, but don't burn, khilanam shivamastuva, for whatever remaining trees are there, let there be astu, shivamastu, let there be auspiciousness for them, don't burn those trees. Varkshiya esha varakanya, so here is this kanya, varakanya, she can be your bride, patnitve pratigruhiyatam, accept her as your wife, and she is the daughter of the trees. So Soma is considered to be the king of the trees, and thus he has that authority. So he offers their daughter of the trees as a bride for them. So usually, so again, this whole thing is like a Kshatriya conquest. Now when one Kshatriya attacks another kingdom, and then when there is a treaty made at that time, you know, they decide to stop the war. So at that time, something is offered as a sign of peace, as a peace offering. So it may be tribute, it may be wealth, and sometimes to seal an agreement between two kingdoms, quite often a marital bond is formed. And through a marital bond, there is a much greater level of security to the connection, because now we are related through marriage. So then the hostilities cease substantially. So here, by offering the daughter, they're saying that now this is also what they're using for pacifying. So the Prachitas are Kshatriyas, and then they're offered the daughter of the tree to the queen, and we see that at this point, through the Sam, Dheda and Dam, the Prachitas, they become pacified. Iti amantrivararoham, amantrivararoham, kanyam apsarasindrupa, kanyam apsarasindrupa, somo rajayayo dattva,
somo rajayayo dattva,
te dharme no paye mire,
te dharme no paye mire.
Iti amantrivararoham. In this way, when they advised him, he spoke in this way. Kanya apsarasin rupa. So this kanya was apsarasin. She was the daughter of apsarasi, of an apsara, pramalocha. So she was given in this way. Somo raja yayodatva. After giving, he departed. And they dharme opaye mire. And then according to dharma, they married her. So in fact, this marriage of the Prachetas to the daughter of the trees, this is quoted in the Mahabharata as a praman for Draupadi's marrying the five Pandavas. So normally in the Vedic culture there was polygamy, but polygamy usually was that one husband, one man had many wives, and there are multiple reasons for that. One major reason was that the women needed protectors, and if the female population was more than the male population, then the women would need protectors, and one man would have many wives. But in some exceptional situations, one woman could also have many husbands. And this is given as a previous instance of this thing happened. And here also how it is, Soma is a devata, he is a higher being than human beings, and he has sanctioned it. So they married in dharma. So normally the dharma is referred to, because usually it is not so common for one woman to have many husbands. But according to dharmic principles, as per the instruction of Soma, they married him. Tebhyastasyam sambhavad, tebhyastasyam sambhavad, dakshah prachetasah kila,
dakshah prachetasah kila,
yasya prajavisargena, loka apuritastrayah. So now here in one verse, the summary is given, and then this will be elaborated later, but girl, Tebhyas, Tasyam Sambhavat, was born Daksha Prachetasah. So Prachetas, their son Prachetasah was Daksha, he was born, and he Prajavisargena, he created a population by which Loka Apuritastri, all the three worlds were populated through him. So now, here, Chakravarti Pada explains in his commentary further that actually there was Daksha Prajapati, who is described in the fourth canto. And then he is cursed and he dies. Now he is reborn. Right now what is going on? Right now still the Chayambhu Manvantara is only going on. And Daksha Prajapati does his creation in the Chakshusha Manvantara. So he actually performs austerities for a long time. And by performing austerities, eventually he populates the universe. So they quote a verse for the fourth canto where it is stated that in Chakshusha Manvantara, he filled the universe with population. Now, here he goes on and further describes how he went on under the creation. Yatha sasarja bhutani, asasarja bhutani, daksho duhitra vatsalaha,
daksho duhitra vatsalaha,
retasa manasa chaiva, manasa chaiva, tan mama vahitah vishnu, tan mama vahitah vishnu, upama vahitah. When I am speaking here attentively, yatha sasarja bhutani, how he created the living beings, daksha duhitra vatsalaha. It's interesting, he said that he loved his daughters. So actually he had acted in a very heartless way with his daughters. You know, Daksha and Shiva is their whole pastime in the fourth canto, but he loved his daughter. It was that particular time, because of an ego issue, he had acted in a very heartless way. The father, he loved his daughters. It's an interesting describer useful. The Vitra Vatsalaha. And Retasa Manasa Chaiva. How did he create? In two ways. Through semen and through mind. I'll explain how he created all of them. Manasaiva Srijat Purvam.
Manasaiva Srijat Purvam.
प्रजापतिर्मह प्रजः प्रजापतिर्मह प्रजः देवासुरमनुष्यादि
देवासुरमनुष्यादि
नभस्तलजलौकसः
नभस्तलजलौकसः.
So he created with his mind. What did he create? Manasaiva asrujat. Purvam, with his mind he created earlier Prajapati, Imapaja, all these populations. Dev, Asur, Manushyadim. So basically the three worlds it was mentioned. Devatas, Asuras and Manavas. Nabhan Sthala Jalaukasaha. On the earth, on the sky. Sthala, Nabha is the sky, Sthala is the earth, Jala is the water. So basically he creates, I created aquatics, he created terrestrial animals, and he created the aviaries, the birds. All of them he created. Tam amrumhitam alokya prajasargam prajapatihi
prajasargam prajapatihi
vindyapadan upavrajya
vindyapadan upavrajya
socharadushkaram tapaha
socharadushkaram tapaha.
So when he saw alokya abrumhitam, he saw that actually the population is not increasing. Prajasargam prajapati. He had his mission of expanding the population. That was his duty. Vindhya padan upavrajya. So he went to the foothills of Vindhya and dushkaram tapaha. He went there to perform difficult austerities. So it's interesting. Prajapati. The whole concept of prajapati, one who is the progenitor. So if we see, there is a whole person who is entrusted the responsibility of begetting. So it's sometimes, you know, we may have, especially when we are in the renounced order, we may have a very negative perception of grihastha life and of sex. Sex is essential for procreation. That is the way the system has been arranged. For most living beings, there is procreation through sex. There may be, for a few cases, there might be through so asexual reproduction is there in our observation, and then through the mind there will be reproduction. So, but producing progeny and maintaining the dynasty, that is also an important responsibility. And in fact, it is said that if somebody is a grihastha, somebody is a householder, then one of their duties is to their ancestors. And the duty to the ancestors is not just to do pindadan for their well-being, it is also to beget children and continue the dynasty. That is also considered a responsibility. So, children are seen as the gifts of God. And children are to be treasured. If you have, in the early days of our movement, people would have a very, very negative. The devotees came from, they didn't have the whole cultural context. See, talk of renunciation makes sense when there is a culture of responsibility. When people don't have any sense of responsibility only, then what happens? That aversion to responsibility is equated with renunciation. But that is not correct. So one has to have the culture of taking up responsibility, and then one gives up that responsibility for taking up a higher responsibility of spiritual growth. So what happened is, if one has only a negative conception, so it happened that sometimes some devotees, when they would have children rather being seen as gifts of God, rather than being seen as gifts of God, were seen as products of lust. These children, they are the products of lust. And what should you do with them? You know, they are products of lust. You just send them to the Gurukul and you continue your service. Done it, now forget it. Now, the idea of the Gurukul was also seen as very negative. Not so much as a place where children would be cultivated in good qualities. Rather, it was seen as, get those children out of the way so that you can start your services again. So it was a very negative conception. And that sort of negative conception has to be avoided. Now, it's a part of the universal order that there is procreation happening. And that is also a responsibility. Of course, that is not our only responsibility, and somebody shouldn't think that my responsibility is to procreate. And of course, many times when people enjoy sex, procreation is not even in their minds. Or rather, procreation is very much in their minds in a way that they want to avoid it. So they may take pills or they may do whatever things by which they can avoid procreation. So that is certainly wrong. But the point is that we shouldn't see the whole thing negatively. Daksha Prajapati, you know, it's that he's some population he creates with the mind, some population he creates with Retasa, he creates through semen also. And it's not that activity itself is to be demonized. So now, this comes to the major part of this chapter, that how he offers prayers. So, tatraghamarshanam nama.
Tatraghamarshanam nama.
Tirtham papaharam param.
Tirtham papaharam param.
Upasvishyanusavanam.
Upasvishyanusavanam.
Tapasatoshayadharim.
Tapasatoshayadharim.
So, tapasatoshayad, for satisfying the performance of the Harim, for Lord Harim. So, what is the Tirtham papaharam param, that Lord who is, he went to the holy place called Aghamarshan, which Aghamarshan papaharam, which destroys sins. And there he performed austerities and he satisfied the Supreme Lord. Astau shiddhar dharm dhamsaguhyena,
astau shiddham saguhyena,
bhagavantam adhokshajam,
bhagavantam adhokshajam.
Tubhyam tad abhidhasyami,
tubhyam tad abhidhasyami.
Kasya tushyad yathahari,
kasya tushyad yathahari.
So the previous verse he says that he toshed hari, now kasya tushyad yathahari. So how he satisfied hari, that I'll describe to you now. The dhamsa guhyena, so the dhamsa guhya prayer which he offered, that is described. Bhagwanda madoshyad, that Lord who is inconceivable. And Abhidhasyami, he worshipped him and he praised him in this way, he satisfied him. So what are those prayers? I will describe that to you. So before we start with the prayers, any questions till now? Related with what we discussed? Yeah. Is meat eating sinful for people in general, or is it just something to be avoided for those who want to make spiritual progress? Both are true. Spiritual progress comes when we have a sense of empathy. If we don't see the life in living beings, especially when the life is so clearly manifested as in animals, then that indicates a very a significant deadening of the consciousness, and that is very unconducive for spiritual awareness. Pashugna, we say that those who eat meat, they cannot understand. Puman Rajya Vina Pashugna, the 10th canto also says so. But definitely it's unfavorable for people who want to make spiritual progress. At the same time, there is a law of karma. By the law of karma, there are sinful reactions to the action that we do. And when we cause pain to other living beings, there are reactions to that. So, now, if we see the laws of nature or the pictures that were made based on Prabhupada's direction, it is said that people who eat meat, they go to hell and suffer. And we see the 5th canto also, there are descriptions similarly. So the point is, that in certain situations, meat eating may be a necessity. And when it is a necessity, it is to be done. But when it is not, it is to be avoided. Certainly there are sinful actions, sinful activity over there, because they are killing life. And killing life is definitely sinful. So, it's not that it is, when we say something is, something may be, the body may allow it, but that does not mean there is no karma in it. It's like people can say, I can have extramarital and premarital sex. My body is healthy, I can do that. But then, there is karma involved over there. So like that, meat eating also, there is karma involved over there. Because the animals are killed and that is not the prescribed food. See, even Prabhupada says in that Ishopanishad also, humans have canine teeth. Maybe sometimes they can eat meat if they want. But the prescribed food, tena tektena bhunjita maagodhavasasudhana. So the prescribed food is vegetables, fruits, grains. But in some situations, something else may be eaten and there is serious karma involved over there. So it is meant for exceptional situations and it is not recommended definitely. And there is sinful reaction involved. So both from the material perspective also. Now there is a lot of studies coming up which show that humans are much more healthier with vegetarian food than with non-vegetarian food. And I wrote an article on my website, this full article about eat to help the world. So HELP is acronym. So how our own health, how the environment, how the livestock, and how poverty. How our health is improved, the ecology is helped, we prevent the livestock from having succumbed to so much suffering, and poverty. We actually help in alleviating poverty by shifting to a vegetarian diet. So definitely, from the negative perspective of karmic reactions, from the positive perspective of helping to create a better world, vegetarian food is good, not just from the spiritual perspective, even from the material perspective also. Clear? Yeah? Reference for the duty to the parents, or duty to the ancestors, or reference for what?
Maintain the
vamsha. Okay. Is there any reference for that? Actually, first of all, we definitely see that anxiety among kings. Now, kings often go to great extents performing various yajnas and doing various things to get heir so that their kingdom can continue. So that is definitely responsibility. Now, we may say that is the responsibility primarily for the king, so that there is a successor who will maintain the kingdom. But then the same applies to others also. There are landlords, there are ministers, and it is general kshatriya, especially for kshatriyas, it's a very important responsibility. And there are different kinds of yajna that are talked about. So there is deva yajna, there is pitra yajna, rishi yajna. So to the devatas, we do yajna by doing the agnihotra and other sacrifices. The rishis, we do yajna by studying scripture from them, studying the scripture that they are given, and by serving them. And the pitras, we do yajna by actually offering pinda to them, and by procreating and continuing on the dynasty. And like that, so that Prabhupada talks about pancha maha yajna. So there is a yajna for the general living being, for other human beings, and for all living beings. So like that, there are pancha maha yajna which are described to avoid the pancha maha suna, the five great sins that are there, which inevitably happen in material existence. But this is to be done. So it's a standard part of the karmakanda way of living. Sometimes when we talk about karmakanda, we just denigrate it. But karmakanda is a system for material harmony and material prosperity. It's not wrong. So there is what has happened in India is that the material responsibility is equated with responsibilities. People think that my only responsibility is to make sure that my son gets settled, my daughter gets married, and I take care of my family members. That is a responsibility. But that is not the only responsibility. So now, as far as people being asked and made fun of, who is your ancestor, who is your great-grandfather, great-great-grandfather, there are different ways of perceiving things in different cultures. So especially in the modern culture, it's a highly individualistic culture. Yeah, you know, people in general are I specialists. So in such an individualist culture, you know, where I come from, my connectedness with where I am coming from, that is not given much importance. But not only in India, even if you look at pre-colonial Europe, or colonial Britain, or pre-colonial Europe, at that time, you know, people would have, in the West, they would have something called a family Bible. Family Bible means not the family's Bible, the sacred book, but Family Bible means that was a book where they would have the list of their ancestors. And then every new member that is born in the family, the name is added. Every person that has died, that is added over there. It's a standard tradition. Not just it is in Europe, it is in America also. So that connected, wherever there is a culture that is individualistic, that is lost. But whether there is a community-based culture, or that is quite an important part. And we see that even the Bhagavatam, it repeatedly talks about people in terms of their dynastic connections. You are Kurunandana, you are Vrishni, So why does if it's just something which is unimportant, why are they talking about? The idea is often our awareness of our connection invokes responsibility within us. It's like if I understand that I am representing this particular dynasty and there are so many great people in the dynasty, then I have to maintain that legacy and I also have to act responsibly. So there is the Bhagavad Gita also talks about Kula Dharma, isn't it? Kula Dharma Sanatana. He says that Kula Dharma will be destroyed if we kill people. So Kula Dharma, it is not the Paradharma, but it is an important dharma also. So that's how that is also a part of the broad Vedic culture. You clear? Yes, please. Yeah, correct. So how do we so if there is killing involved in and plants, and then what is the big difference between being vegetarian and being non-vegetarian? Multiple. We can talk from the scientific perspective, we can talk from the karmic perspective, we can talk from the emotional perspective, we can talk from the aesthetic perspective. So from the scientific perspective, any sensitive human being would not like to cause pain to others. Or if pain is to be caused, cause as less pain as possible to others. That is just a normal cultured way people should behave. So, from the scientific perspective, plants have a far less developed nervous system than animals. And that's why even when they die, the souls in the plant body is also attached to the plant body. But its consciousness itself is less. When the consciousness is less, the amount of pleasure it can experience is less, the amount of pain it experiences also is less. So, and that is manifested through their underdeveloped nervous system. So plants suffer far lesser pain than animals. It's not just that the animals can visually, they can scream and they can move their hands and legs. And that's why we can say that if we see their pain, we can't see the plant's pain. It's not like that. It is true, we can see the plant animal's pain and not the plant's pain. But additionally, the plants actually, because of their lesser nervous system, they suffer less, much, much lesser. And same principle, if we take from the karmic perspective, the amount of pain we cause, that much karmic reaction we are going to get. So the extent of pain that is caused in the case of animals is far, far greater than the extent of pain that is caused in the case of plants. Thirdly, in many cases, in the case of plants, the fruits just fall off the tree. So there is no killing involved that way. Even if you consider grains, grains, actually, if they are not harvested at that time, they will just die. So if we see, the grains have more or less, by the time they grow, they have lived their life. And after that, they will just rot and die. So their life is more, when they are harvested, their life is more or less over by that time. After that, they will just decay. In contrast, when animals are killed, animals are usually killed when they are fully grown. It's not when they're old, especially in harvesting places. They are killed when they are young. So it is their life is cut short. In the case of harvesting, the life is more or less going to end after that time. They are not going to live for a long time. So intuitively also, or from an aesthetic point of view, if we see that in not just in Indian culture, but everywhere in the world, harvesting is a time of celebration. People sing songs, people have festivals at the time of harvesting. But if we go to a slaughterhouse, it's not a season of celebration over there. It's a very, very gloomy and grim atmosphere. There's blood all around, there's screaming and screeching. People may say that, there is killing in both. But suppose that person is a parent. Ask the parent. If in your school they tell that you want to take the children for a field trip, you will take them to harvesting to see how crops are harvested. No parent will oppose. But you tell them they are going to take them to a field trip to a slaughterhouse to see how animals are slaughtered. No parent will allow that, practically speaking. Very few parents will. Why is that? Because intuitively we know there is a difference. So actually when crops are harvested, nature has given her bounty. And we are grateful that nature has given the bounty and we are actually celebrating. And nature is also in a festive mood at that time. So, but on the other hand, when animals are slaughtered, it's completely different. It's the animal's lifespan is being cut short. and it's a very brutal, bloody atmosphere over there. So Prabhupada also said, even if you have to eat meat, he says, let the animal die its natural course and then you can eat the meat. You just have to wait for some time, then you can eat that. Prabhupada did not oppose that so much. So, in this sense, we can, even from a, without going into Shastra so much, from a common sense point of view, you can say that there is a big, big difference between plants and animals. And that's why killing plants is, ultimately, jivo jivo sa jivo. We have to kill someone to live. So, if we don't kill, we ourselves will not be able to live. But while killing, we should try to create, cause as less pain as possible. And that is why we avoid, we are told to avoid eating meat, avoid killing animals, and then ultimately, of course, as devotees, we are not just vegetarians, we are Krishnatarians, as we say. We don't just take vegetarian food, we take the vegetarian food that is offered to Krishna. And then when we take that food, that is actually very much karma free. So even the karmic consequences that are involved in killing animals, even that is avoided when we offer it to Krishna. Does that answer your question?
Means when the victim is killed, then the time?
That time?
So much. When the victim is killed, what does that have to do with the king? Then we say that the king is dead, then the king is dead. But when the plant is dead, grasses are dead, then the plant is dead. 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 Then the grass is dead.
Okay. Yeah. So sometimes if you want to cultivate some trees or cultivate crops, at that time to grow one thing, we may have to pluck a lot of grasses. So if we are killing, say, destroying 100 grasses to say have one plant or something like that. So is it that we should be concerned only about some plants and not others? So there are two different things over here. Within the plant also, they decide that there are sattvic, rajasic and tamasic plants. So sattvic plants are, sattvaguna is basically, tamaguna is, sattvaguna means, you know, we share. Whatever we have, we share. Rajoguna means, you know, I first. Okay, whatever there, I want the best part. I want the first part. And tamoguna means I only. Everyone else will be destroyed. I will take everything. It's like that. So that is the broad understanding of the modes. Where there is higher modes means lesser selfishness. I also want things. But let's all share equally. So now, if we look at trees, some trees, they just give a lot. Let's say big plants and big trees, if you see. There are so many ways in which they are giving, and they give fruits, and they offer shade, and they offer houses for birds. They are giving in so many ways. But there are some plants which just don't give anything. You know, just occupy space, and especially weeds. This just occupy space, and weeds don't contribute anything to anyone. So they are just spreading wildly and consuming the space. So in that sense, those plants which simply take and don't give, they are considered tamasic, they are considered a lower level. Those which give, those which contribute, they are considered sattvic. And in some cases, killing the tamasic vegetation for cultivating sattvic vegetation is acceptable. Because ultimately, it's an ecosystem in which everyone has to contribute. So something is taking more than what it is giving, then the cutting that is fair enough. And quite often we see these kind of things which we say for weeds and grasses. You know, they also don't need any cultivation, they just grow automatically. So you know, they are killed, others will grow. And as far as killing one soul for 100 souls is concerned, you know, we have to see that basically it's not just like our purpose is not primarily to kill. Our purpose is to cultivate land so that it can be used properly for various constructive purposes, ultimately for the service of the Lord. So whatever is favorable for that, we do that. Is it clear? Okay. So, shall we move ahead? Okay. Last question.
Where the soul stays in the brains, there are strong souls or not? souls are ended after sowing the souls, so seeds inside the body. This is the first question. Second question is, our Brahmanas are allowed in because in Mahabharata sections are there.
Yeah. Okay, first question. I think. Okay. So, where the soul is soul present in grains, or where is soul present in plants? I have not read any specific statement about where the soul is present, but there is that statement of Chandogya Upanishad which Prabhupada quotes in the 13th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita purport, that you know, the soul, when it falls from the spiritual world, it comes through rains, and then the rains fall and drops fall on the ground, and then they grow as grains, and the grains are eaten by human beings, and the human beings, that soul enters into the semen, and then it goes into another body, and that's how the soul gets a body on earth. That is one way it can happen. It's not the only way it can happen. That's one way it's described. So it seems that in that case, grains are talked about as containing the souls. So broadly speaking, how do we understand the presence of the soul? We may say it's by consciousness. But then how do we know whether something is conscious or not? So, actually speaking, that which is having life, there's matter which does not have life and matter which has life. Matter is never living, but I'm talking about has life means matter which has soul in it. And matter which has soul, not just as an abstract presence, but as an active principle. That means that that matter comprises a body for that soul in some way. So when if we talk about the embodied soul, another way we could talk about the ensouled matter. Ensouled matter means matter in which soul is present. So when there is ensouled matter, that undergoes the six transformations. There is creation, there is growth, maintenance, reproduction, and there is destruction. Maintenance is there. Creation, there is creation, growth, maintenance, reproduction, deterioration, and destruction. Now, when we talk about the matter which is not, which has no soul in it, that basically goes only through three phases. It's created, it deteriorates, and it is destroyed. Now, if my hand is cut, then it will clot and it will maintain itself. It will try to maintain itself. Now, if this bar is cut, that bar will not try to heal and join itself. So that tendency to maintain itself, that tendency to reproduce, that tendency to grow, that indicates the presence of life, which indicates the presence of consciousness. So in that sense, the seeds which grow, there is soul present in them, without which growth would not have happened. They grow, they reproduce, they maintain themselves, all that things are there. Now, at what stage the soul comes in that seed, that is something which is difficult to say. I have not seen any Shastic Praman. So, it could well be that the souls are looking for bodies, and whenever there is a suitable biochemical medium, the souls enter over there. That means it's not necessary that all grains have souls, but when the grains are placed in a situation where they can grow, where they can grow into, either we have to talk about seeds which grow into plants or grains which grow into further grains, then it is at that time the soul enters. So, I have not seen any specific praman about that, that's why I cannot say. But the broad principle you can see, wherever there is growth, maintenance, reproduction happening, there has to be a soul present over there. And because some grains do definitely go through this, so the soul enters. And exactly when it enters, you know, that is something which is not necessarily always in the same mechanism. Sometimes we say that it is the consciousness of the soul or consciousness of the husband and the wife which determines the kind of child that is born. Now that is true, but then it is also said that actually there are so many, when a man and a woman unite, there are actually so many sperms in this through the semen, there are so many sperms that enter into it. So is it Pumsa Reta Kanashwe? Is it Pumsa that it takes shelter of a sperm? So is it that all the sperms contain the souls? Or is it that only the sperm that contains the soul that enters the womb, that unites with the egg, and that's how a child is produced? Or is it that actually there are many sperms that contain souls, not necessarily all, but many sperms that contain souls, and depending on the consciousness at that time, the soul who has the appropriate consciousness, that soul unites with the egg at that time. So this is all subtle, gahana karmanogati, as we say. This is not really within human perception. And when scripture doesn't tell us anything specifically, as far as I have seen, I have not read it. So we really can't know about it. But what we understand is that there are subtle mechanisms by which the souls are transmigrated from one body to another, and then they are given appropriate bodily expression. So seeds that grow definitely contain a soul. At what stage they gain it, that may vary according to various factors, time, place, circumstance, or whatever it is. Are Brahmanas allowed to eat meat? See, when we talk about Brahmanas, also there are at one level Brahmanas are meant to be Sattvaguna. But then there are Sattvic, Rajasic, Tamasic rituals also. Isn't it? We say there is Tamasic worship. And who is going to do the Tamasic worship? Sattvic Brahmanas are not going to do the Tamasic worship. So there are Brahmanas who are meant to do the Tamasic rituals also. And those Brahmanas who do the Tamasic rituals, they may also eat meat. So there are Brahmanas who are, for example, when Ravana starts fighting with Ram's forces, at that time Ravana has, the Rakshasas have their own Brahmanas. They are called Yatudhanas. Yatudhanas, and they perform rituals for invoking auspiciousness for Ravana. Now they are the Brahmanas of the Rakshasas, and then they are going to perform rituals of that category. So especially those Brahmanas who are administering Shakta rituals. Shakta worship is often quite tamasic, not always, but sometimes. When it is, so those may be eating meat. The Mahabharata does say at one particular place that when Yudhishthira is going up towards Badrikashram, towards high up in the mountains, so he said there are a large number of Brahmanas who are accompanying him, and he says at one particular point that now as we move up, food will be very difficult to get. And he says to the Brahmanas, respectfully, those of you who cannot live without meat, please go to some other king. He will shelter you. I cannot provide for you now. So it is not that he was killing animals and providing for them. But then there was the situation where meat was available. So there are sections. See, as I said, we have to, you know, if we try to look at Vedic scriptures and try to see the principles of Krishna consciousness within the Vedic principle and within the Vedic scriptures, we will find them. But if we try to look and think that all the Vedic scriptures should be talking only about the principles of Krishna consciousness, we will not find that. So, as I told you, one thing is, Prabhupada has not given us Vedic culture. He has given us the best of Vedic culture. Vedic culture has a large level of, multiple levels of things in it. And then if we think that, you know, everything in the Vedic scripture should equate with Krishna consciousness, then we will always live in a perpetual state of insecurity. No, how do I make sense of this? Why is this there? Why is this there? Why is this there? No, the Vedic culture is very broad. It is inclusive. There are multiple levels of people at multiple levels of consciousness, and they are all accommodated, facilitated to move onwards in a gradual way. So what Prabhupada has given us is like the elevator, the super fast way. And the Bhagavatam also, it's not as Prabhupada has given it. The Bhagavatam itself acknowledges the path of bhakti is rare. Muktanam pisiddhanam narayana parayanam sudurlabha prashantatma koteshwar mahamuni. So even among sages, among munis, among liberated people, the bhaktas are rare. So in that sense, bhakti is a rare path. Did I answer your question? So we have to move on. Yes, Prabhu. I don't know about that. Actually, even there we see that people would deal with animals in a very affectionate way. Not just Brahmanas dealing with cows, but even horses. Chariots had their horses and they would have a special relationship with their horses. And taking care of horses was itself a whole developed field. So, what? So if we talk about rasa in terms, if we think of rasa simply as an emotional connection, then certainly there can be connection between human beings and animals. There's no doubt about that. But if we're talking about rasa in terms of, say, a fulfilling, emotionally fulfilling relationship, then maybe that is not possible. Maybe Prabhupada is referring to that. I'll see if I find out about this. Prabhupada is probably not using rasa there in terms of emotional connection. Because Prabhupada himself was asked which is the best animal. Devotees thought Prabhupada would say cow, Prabhupada said horses. So he said, so basically, not best in absolute sense, but in the best in the sense of the culture, I would say the cultural context. So, but we can see that there is the affection to Shivananda, the dog that Shivananda Sen also shows. So that is of course within the field of bhakti. But so the emotional connection is definitely possible, and Prabhupada has talked about it elsewhere also. No. So that is talked in an unfavorable way when Prabhupada talks about how much people pamper their dogs. He talks about it negatively, but he acknowledges that existence of an emotional connection. But Prabhupada is probably referring to rasa in some specific sense where, you know, the word rasa has a meaning that that is coming in the Pibad Bhagavatam Rasamalayam, you know, that verse. So there rasa actually means a evolved emotion which elevates the consciousness. The Bhagavatam is saying rasa is a rasika. So rasa is not just an emotion. Rasa is an emotion that elevates one's consciousness. And it can be experienced by a rasika. It can be, that means just like in a drama, in a stage, if Bharatanatyam is performed. Now, an ignorant person who doesn't know what is that is being depicted, what is, they can just not understand, what is this hand, legs and movement? What is this movement of hands and legs? But those who know, they can appreciate. So, maybe rasa can be appreciated by rasika. So, maybe in terms of some kind of emotional fulfillment, that is not possible for the, that kind of fulfilling relationship is not, may not be possible with human beings and animals. I think we need to move on to talk later. So, now actually, this is going to be slightly intellectually demanding because this is a whole philosophical section about the prayers that are offered by Daksha Prajapati, and what we'll do is, we may not be, I was originally planning to complete all the prayers, but we'll not be able to complete it. We'll discuss maybe for half an hour and then we can have some more question answers. Shri Prajapati Vacha Namah Paraya Vita Vita Namah Paraya Vita Vita गुणत्रयाभासनिमित्तबन्धवे अदृष्टधाम्ने गुणतत्त्वबुद्धिभिः निवृत्तमानाय दधे स्वयंभुवे. नमः. आई ऑफर ओबेइसेंसेस दैट लॉर्ड हु इज स्वयंभुवे, हु इज सेल्फ मैनिफेस्टेड, हु इज सेल्फ बॉर्न. Prajapati is going to create. He knows I am created and I am going to create others. But this Lord is self-manifested. He is again as in a different category of being. He is not created by anyone. So sometimes Brahma is also called as self-born. But he is not literally self-born. He is actually born from Vishnu. He is self-born in the sense that he is not born through procreation in a normal way. But he, the Lord alone, is ultimately Swayambhu, self-manifested. Namaha Paraya. Paraya means he is superior, he is transcendental. He is beyond Jiva, he is beyond Maya. Anubhutaye means that Lord who grants experience of himself. He is himself knowledge. He is himself the realization, which is the ultimate realization. Anubhute. He is meant to be ultimately experienced. Gunatrayabhasa nimitta bandhave. So, nimitta means the instrumental cause. So, he is the person who actually activates the modes. He is the ultimate activator of the modes. He is the activator of the jivas. Without him, neither the jivas can act nor the modes can act. Adrishta dhamne. So, dham can refer to his abode. Dham can also refer to his form. So, now to there is a philosophical flow in the verses. So, to clarify the philosophical flow, I have found Chakravarti Pad's translations more easy to connect in terms of a flow. So, I will mostly talk in terms of his translations. So, Adrishta dhamne here refers to that his form is invisible. So, the theme of this prayer is that the Lord is invisible and he becomes visible through purity. That's the theme of the Amsaguya prayer. So, Adrishta dhamne. His form is not visible. Gunatva buddhi bhi. For those who think, those buddhi thinks that the guna is the tattva. That means their intelligence thinks that the products of material nature are the truth. This world is the reality and that is all that is there. There is nothing more than that. Nivrittamanaya dadhe svayambhuve. Nivrittamanaya. That Lord who is beyond our capacity to know, I offer obeisances to him. So we are under the modes, he is beyond the modes. He cannot be known by us. Now, although he is very difficult to know, he is actually very close to us. How he is close to us, how he is very, not just in location, but also in disposition. That is mentioned in the next verse. Now, if somebody says, you know, he is unknown, somebody may ask the question, why do you need to know him? You know, okay, you don't know about Africa, so why do I need to know about Africa? What is the relevance? So, actually the Lord is unknown, but he is very important for us, he is very close to us. That is stressed in the next verse. Na yasya sakhyam purusho vaiti sakhyo. Na yasya sakhyam purusho vaiti sakhyo. Sakhavasan samvasatah pureyasmin.
Sakhavasan samvasatah pureyasmin.
Guno yatha guno vyakta drishte.
Guno yatha guno vyakta drishte.
Tasmai maheshaya namaskaromi.
Tasmai maheshaya namaskaromi.
So, and to that Lord who is Mahesh, who is a great Lord, namaskaromi, I offer obeisances. So, how is that Lord described? Na yasya sakhyam, his friendship is not known. Purusho avaiti sakhyu. He is the friend, his friendship is not known to the living being. Avaiti. Sakha, how is he a friend? He is such a close friend that he resides not just near us, but inside us. Sakha vasan samvasatah pureyasmin. In this very body he resides close to us. And then how is he not known? Guno yatha gunino vyakta drishtes. That guno yatha gunino. That means just as the sense objects can do not know the revealing power of the senses. Chakravarti Pad translates. Basically what he means is that the senses have the capacity of perception. The sense objects don't have the capacity of perception. Here we are not talking about say a man and a woman looking at a woman, but a person looking at a particular building or of any form. The eyes have the capacity to see the form. The form doesn't have the capacity to see the eyes. The same example was given in the previous chapter also. That the point is not of consciousness, the point is of the hierarchy. So the Lord exists at a higher level in our hierarchy and we don't have the hierarchy above us and thus we don't have the capacity to know him. But he is our friend and he is very close to us. Both in location and in disposition. In disposition, let's say two people may be living close to each other. They may be neighbors, but you know, they may be quarrels, and they may be far away. Sometimes in a family, there may be husband and wife living together, but they are physically close, they are emotionally very far. So, the Lord is close to us not just in location, He's in our heart, but He's also in disposition. He cares for us, He loves us. Surudam sarabhutana, the well-wisher of all living beings. Deho asavo akshamanavo bhuta matram.
Deho asavo akshamanavo bhuta matram.
Atmanam anyam cha vidho param yat.
Atmanam anyam cha vidho param yat.
Sarvam puman veda gunam cha tajgyo.
Sarvam puman veda gunam cha tajgyo.
Na veda sarvagyam anantamide.
Na veda sarvagyam anantamide.
Ide, Ide means to worship. I worship that Lord, Ananda, who is unlimited, the Veda Sarvajnam. You know, he is all knowing, but we cannot know him. So Veda Sarvajnam is like, you know, there is to know Naveda and Sarvajnam. He knows everyone, but he is not to be known. So now he talks further about that hierarchy. Just as it was said that the sense objects cannot know the senses. Similarly, in the hierarchy, Deho Asav Akshamanavo Bhuta Matram. The body, the asavo is the life air, the eyes, the mind, the bhuta matram, the gross elements. Atmanam Anyani Chamidho Param Yat. So all of these, they cannot know the Atma. They cannot know themselves, they cannot know other things, they cannot know the Jiva. They don't have consciousness. Now, Sarvam Atmanam Anyam Chavidho Param Yat. Atma can know these things. They cannot know these things. The Atma has consciousness. Similarly, Sarvam Puman Veda Gunamsh Panjgyom. So, the living entity can know all these things, but he cannot know the Parampurusha. So again, the point is the hierarchy of being. Why is this hierarchy of being talked about repeatedly in the Bhagavatam? It is important to understand the relative position of things. You know, there is tradition that there are tattvatray in existence. There is the Jagat, there is the Jiva, and there is the Jagdish. Jagat, Jiva, and Jagdish. The alliteration of Jiva in this terminology. So in that hierarchy, the Jagat is lacking consciousness. Jiva can know the Jagat. Jagdish can know the Jiva and the Jagat. But the Jiva, it is difficult for him to know the Jagat. Because actually we are subordinate to the Supreme Lord. And that is also a reason why material science cannot know God. Because material science operates by controlling matter. Now we observe matter, we control matter, and subject it to controlled experiments to see whether the predicted behavior is repeated or not. So material science requires the control of the object to be observed and studied. Whereas God being above us, he cannot be controlled by us. And because he cannot be controlled by us, so he cannot be understood through the methodology of material science. Now I write these articles in the Bhagavad Gita daily. I wrote one article to understand Krishna, stand under Krishna. To understand Krishna, we cannot understand Krishna by intellectual conquest. To stand under Krishna, we have to subordinate ourselves to him. So we don't know him by our intellectual power, rather we know him by submitting ourselves to him, and he by his higher power will reveal himself to us. That revelation, that principle of revelation, we will talk about later in this verses. So in this verse, again the same point is being stressed, that he cannot be known. Because we are lower in the hierarchy of being. Now, after talking about his position, now how he can be known, that starts off over here. 26th, Yado Paramo Manaso Nam Rupa.
Yado Paramo Manaso Nam Rupa.
Rupasya Drishta Smriti Sam Pramosha.
Rupasya Drishta Smriti Sam Pramosha.
Yaiyate Kevalaya Swasamsthaya.
Yaiyate Kevalaya Swasamsthaya.
Hamsaya tasme shuchi sad mane namaha.
Hamsaya tasme shuchi sad mane namaha.
So, namaha, again after this, obeisance is Hamsaya, that Lord who is pure, shuchi sad mane. When the consciousness becomes purified, at that time he can be known. Yado paramo manaso namarupa. Uparama. Uparama means cessation. So, manaso, the mind's obsession with Namarupa. Namarupa is a standard term used in the Upanishads to refer to material existence. No? Material existence is filled with Namarupa. So it's often used as a shorthand to refer to material existence as names and forms. So when the mind's obsession with Namarupa stops, Yadopara Ramo Manaso Namarupa, at that time, Rupasi Drishtisvati Sampramoshat. So the mind which actually perceives and gets obsessed with all the sense objects, rupasya drishti smriti sampramoshana. So not only the external objects which are perceived, the mind gets obsessed with them, but even the internal attachment of the mind to those objects, that also is destroyed. So no longer is the mind going externally towards our sense objects, nor is it internally attracted to those objects. At that time, yaiyate kevalaya susamsthaya. At that time, in the pure consciousness, when one is situated, so samsthaya, properly, at that time, that Lord is understood, that Lord is perceived. So when the mind is purified of its material contaminations, then the pure mind can perceive the absolute truth, so samsthaya, in his position. So Prabhupada actually says this refers to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Chakravarti Bhasa says this refers to the Brahman. At this stage, we can perceive the spiritual reality. Both are true. If we consider that at this stage, actually one has become purified and practiced bhakti, then with the mind not infatuated with material things and the mind permeated with devotion, one can perceive the Supreme Lord also. But in this particular flow, the bhakti has not yet been directly talked about, but just the cessation of the mind's obsession with matter is talked about. So, tam vidya dukkha sanyoga vyoga yoga sangitam. In 6.23 in the Bhagavad Gita, it says that there is a alliteration of yoga. Tam vidya dukkha sanyoga vyoga yoga sangitam. So, the word yoga comes three times. So, the contact of the soul with misery, there is a disconnection of the connection of the soul with misery, and that connection is called yoga. So, what that means is that the soul's infatuation with matter stops. So, here the same point is being made over here in this stage. Now, this next two verses are Prabhupada and Chakravarti Pad give entirely different explanations of this. Manishino antaradi san niveshitam. Sashakti bhir navabhish chatriruddhi. Vahanim yathadaruni panchadashyam. Manishaya nishkarshanti gudham. Savai mamashesha vishesha maya. Nisheda nirvan sukhanubhuti. Sa sarva nama sacha vishvarupaha. Prasidatam aniruktatma shakti. Prasidatam, may that Lord be pleased with me. So, what is being talked about here? That manishinam antarudhi sannivesitam. So, basically, this verse talks about how when a person has potency, then that person, by chanting mantras, that person can manifest the fire or can manifest. So, there are brahmanas. There's wood over there. Wood has the potentiality for fire. But when mantras are chanted, the fire manifests through the woods. So basically, this verse is giving this as an example of a manifestation of something which is latent, which is there but is not visible. Fire is not there, but by a mechanism, fire can be manifested. Similarly, purification or invocation of spiritual energy is the mechanism by which the Supreme Lord's presence becomes manifested. Now here, with Navabhi, Sthirudbhi, all these nine things, three things. Now, Prabhupada takes this as all referring to material energy. And Chakravarti Pad takes all this as referring to the spiritual energy. So, when Prabhupada says the Trividbhi, he takes it as referring to three modes. Now, he lists the nine elements of material existence. Nine elements of material existence. So, basically, what is it? That within, so the way Prabhupada takes it is that within this material world also, the Lord is present. Ultimately, the Lord is everywhere. And when one becomes purified, then the Lord's presence becomes manifest in this world also. But the way Chakravarti Pad takes us is that actually there are these three Shaktis. He refers to the Samvit, Samdini and Lagini Shaktis. And then for the nine energies, he talks from there are nine Shaktis which are starting from Vimala, and it is mentioned in the Hari Bhakti Vilas. He talks of Vimala, Utkarshini, Jnana, Kriya, Yoga, Prahavi, Satya, Ishana and Anugraha. These are nine energies. So basically what he says is, this verse is referring to how the Supreme Personality of Godhead is perceived in his spiritual manifestation, in the spiritual world. So he says, by the process of purification, just as by chanting of mantras, fire can get manifested. Similarly, by the practice, by getting purified properly, Savaima Mamashesha Vishesha Maya Nisheda Nirvan Sukhanubhuti. That means there is so much variety in this material world, but there's unlimited variety practically, but it's all maya. So, nishedha nirvana. When one becomes detached from that, when one stops getting entangled in that, at that time, sukhanubhuti, one starts experiencing spiritual bliss. And interestingly, it is said that one has to go beyond all these names, all this material variety. But then it is said, Sar Sarvanama Sacha Vishwarupaha. That Lord is also the source of Sarvanama. All names ultimately come from Him. He is the source of everything, so He is the source of all names also. And He is manifesting as the Vishwarupa also. So that Lord, He is beyond this world, but at the same time, He also pervades this world. And that, so Prabhupada talks about how the Lord, as He pervades in this world, can be manifested. And thus He talks about this, in this all this analysis in terms of material elements. Whereas Chakravarti talks about the Lord's manifestation, not in this world, but beyond this world. His spiritual manifestation in the transcendental world. That is manifested through His transcendental energies. So both are valid, there is different ways of looking at the words. Yadyan niruktam vachasa nirupitam. Yadyan niruktam vachasa nirupitam. Dhyaksha bhirva manaso manaso tayasya.
Dhyaksha bhirva manaso tayasya.
Mabhut swarupam gunarupam hitattad.
Mabhut swarupam gunarupam hitattad.
Savai gunapaya visarga lakshanaha.
Savai gunapaya visarga lakshanaha.
So, Savai, that Lord, guna apaya visarga lakshana. He, visarga is creation, apaya is destruction. So, that Lord is the source of creation and destruction. And, yanya niruktam vachasa nirupitam. Niruktam, that Lord, it cannot be His form, He cannot be defined, He cannot be described by words. Vachasa nirupitam. Nor can He be pursued with the intelligence, dhya, nor with the eyes, akshibir. Akshi is used here to represent the senses. Even by the mind, He cannot be pursued. Ma bhut swarupam gunarupam hitat. Because all these are material. So again, the differentiation between material and spiritual. The Lord cannot be known by material things. So the earlier it said that, okay, by mantra invoking, by purification, He can be known. But by material things alone, He cannot be known. And then, so although He cannot be known, He pervades this world also. He is there in this world. How is there in this world? Let us mention in this next verse. So here there is the alliteration of the Y sound, the ear sound. Yasmin yato yena cha yasya yasmai.
Yato yena cha yasya yasmai.
Yadyo yatha kurute karyate cha.
Yadyo yatha kurute karyate cha.
Paravaresham paramam praprasiddham.
Paravaresham paramam praprasiddham.
Tad brahma tad dhetur ananyat ekam.
Tad brahma tad dhetur ananyat ekam.
So actually there is multiple alliteration in this verse. The ear sound comes 5 times in the first line, 3 times in the second line. That is 8 times. Then the kurute karyate. So that is actually the ka sound in the beginning and the a sound at the end. So there is a double alliteration. Kurute karyate cha. And in the third line, all the words start with pa. So paravaresham paramam praprasiddham. So it's very beautiful poetic verse over here. And actually the translation Chakravarti Pad has given, this also very beautiful. So it is yasmain yato yena cha yasya yasmain. So what is it? That absolute truth in which, from which, by which, of which, unto which everything occurs. Yasmai means in Him. So everything that exists, it exists in Him. Yato. Yato means from Him. Everything has come from Him. Yena. By Him, everything is pervaded. Yena. So yasya. It is of which everything belongs to Him. Yasmai. And unto Him. So it talks about everything comes from Him. Everything is sustained by Him. Everything is ultimately meant for Him. That broad thing, and that is further elaborated. It all belongs to Him. So, yasmin yato yena cha yasya yasmai, yadyo yatha kurute karyate. Not only does everything exist in Him, come from Him and return to Him, but also whatever actions happen in this world, kurute karyate cha. Ultimately, He is the initiator. Without Him, nothing can happen. Paravaresham paramam praprasiddham. That Lord, He is the Supreme Lord, He is transcendental, He is the Supreme Being. So the two aspects of the Absolute Truth are talked about over here. There is His immanence and there is transcendence. Immanence means how the Absolute manifests in this world, how God manifests in this world. And transcendence means how God manifests beyond this world. So Paravaresham, that Lord is also, He manifests in this world, the world would not exist without Him. But at the same time, He has His self-existence beyond this world. Tad brahma tad hetur ananyadekam. So that is the absolute truth that exists. And beyond him nothing exists. He is the ultimate reality. So this is similar to what is talked in the third verse of the Chaturshloki Bhagavatam. That we search into our existence and it is ultimately we come to tajjigyasayadeta. We come to the conclusion that he exists and apart from him nothing exists. So when we say nothing apart from him exists, that is not in the Mayavadi sense. Means we exist, but we are also parts of the absolute. We are also his amshas. This world is also his energy. So when you say God exists, that means God along with energy exists. So this is, he's talking about what is the nature of this. So earlier I said he cannot be known by material means. He can be known by purification. Now he's giving some understanding of what the Lord is. He sustains the world and he transcends the world. Now, here it comes, okay, you're talking about this, but there are different people who have different conceptions of the absolute truth. So, or different conception of things they have. So, what about that? So, he says, this different conceptions are also a result of his energy only. Yachaktayo vadatam vadinam vai. Yachaktayo vadatam vadinam vai. Vivada sammada bhuvo bhavanti.
Vivada sammada bhuvo bhavanti.
Kurvanti chaisham muhuratma moham.
Kurvanti chaisham muhuratma moham.
Tasmai namo ananta gunaya bhumne.
Tasmai namo ananta gunaya bhumne.
So, yachaktayo, by his energy, vadatam vadinam cha. Vadatam, by which there is, people make their own arguments and there are arguments and counter arguments. There is agreement and disagreement. Vivad samvad bhuo bhavanti. So, people make their philosophies vada. And they propagate their vada, and in that there is vivada and samvada. So vada means actually a philosophy, a thought system. Karma vada we have, or whatever kind of vada. But vivada means samvada is discussion, vivada is debate or confrontation. Vivada samvada bhuo bhavanti. So by his energy, different people come up with different ideas, and then they have discussion or confrontation among them. Kurvanti chaisham muhuratma moham. And in this, by such confrontation, what happens is Atma Moham. They actually go deeper into illusion. They are overwhelmed by his material energy. Tasmai Namo Ananta Gunaya Bhumne. Tasmai Namo. Unto that Ananta Lord, that Lord who has unlimited qualities, I offer my obeisances. So it's important, sometimes when we are preaching, we do have sometimes debates and arguments and we try to convince people of the message of bhakti. At the same time, we have to know that there are different people with different convictions. And we should not get too consumed in confrontation. Because sometimes people are too convinced about something. A person, as it is said, a man convinced against his will is of the same opinion still. So people don't give up their opinions. So if somebody is very convinced about something, better end that interaction on a positive note. Now be pleasant, give them some agyat sukriti, I met a nice person and leave it at that. We shouldn't make it, we don't have to, sometimes we may win the argument and lose the person. So our goal is not simply to win the argument, our goal is to win the person over. And sometimes courtesy and gentleness may go a further way in winning the person than confrontation and even defeating a person. So when there is too many arguments, if we see this mood, this is very much there in the Gaudiya tradition, that when Jiva Goswami, he countered the faults that Vallabha Bhatta had found in Rupa Goswami's book. And this is, no, not Rupa Goswami, Rupa Kaviraj, I think Rupa Kaviraj. Rupa Kaviraj had come and he asked Rupa Goswami to sign, was it Rupa Kaviraj? Rupa Narayan, sir. So basically the scholar had come and he asked Rupa Goswami to sign a comment, Jai Patra, he signed it. But Jiva Goswami defeated him. And then he was not very pleased by that, Rupa Goswami. So basically he said, don't waste your time in this confrontation like this. This is not an absolute principle. But the point is, we shouldn't make even confrontation an absolute principle. We have to see what takes us closer to Krishna and what takes others closer to Krishna. So some people just love to argue. And they argue for arguing's sake. So then we just don't have to waste our time in that. So this is, argument can also increase illusion. And that's why sometimes some people just go into comparative religion or comparative philosophy and they say, in this philosophy, this philosophy, this philosophy, this philosophy. And then basically what happens is that any philosophy you present to them, they can find out faults in their philosophy. And it becomes a game for them. It becomes a game in which there is no ultimate victory. Ravindra Swarup Prabhu, he was a philosophy student earlier, before he was introduced to Krishna consciousness. So he writes in an article that he studied philosophy and soon it became a game. Any philosophy you present, you could find out faults in it. And then he said that we started seeing our capacity to find faults in a philosophy as a sign of our intelligence. And then he said, as this was going on and on and on, at one particular point, it just struck me that actually I am being skeptical of everything except skepticism. That means I am being skeptical. Skepticism means, you know, whatever you tell, you approach it with a platform of doubt and criticality. So any philosophy, I try to find faults in it. So I am being skeptical of every philosophy except skepticism. What does that mean? That means, see, skepticism can tell me what is wrong. Skepticism will never tell me what is right. By being skeptical, I will never know what is right. So being skeptical about skepticism means recognizing that skepticism has no truth-revealing potency. It can tell me what is a problem. It can tell me what is wrong, but it can never tell me what is right. So eventually, I have to take a leap of faith. If I don't take a leap of faith, if I am always skeptical, I may come to know all that is wrong, but I will never come to know what is right. That's why in the Bhagavatam also, when it talks about the characteristic of knowledge, samshaya is talked about as one characteristic of knowledge or one characteristic of intelligence. But it is only talked about at one characteristic. It is not doubt is a sign of intelligence, but it is not the only sign of intelligence. No? So, doubt, a foolish person cannot doubt. You know, there are advertisements which are shown and people, gullible people just believe the advertisements. So they don't have the intelligence to doubt. So it requires intelligence to doubt. But intelligence only function is not to doubt. We also have to choose intelligent faith afterwards. So if somebody just goes into too argumentative mode, then they stay in illusion. So when things become too heated in an argument, they can, you know, remember this verse or remember the import, this verse translation, this verse mood, and understand this. There are too much debates happening. Just don't take any sides in it. Get put it aside. This is not really leading to any conclusion. It is all going to cause Atma Moham. And sometimes, you know, even when debates are happening, it is said that when there are debate, there are confrontation between senior Vaishnavas, don't take sides. That's what Chaitanya Bhagavat says. Why? Because, you know, there may be so many subtleties in those debates which we don't know about. And we may unnecessarily become judgmental and offensive. So better not take sides. So now, another, this is a very important verse. I find this verse very inspiring personally. Astiti na astiti cha vastu nishthayor na astiti cha vastu nishthayor ekasthayor bhinna viruddha dharmano ekasthayor bhinna viruddha dharmano avikshitam kinchana yoga sankhyayo avikshitam kinchana yoga sankhyayo samam paramya anukulam brahatat samam paramya anukulam brahatat. So asti iti na asti iti. Basically, there are two schools of thought. So Prabhupada initially talks about astik and nastik, and theist and non-theist, and later he talks about as personalists and impersonalists. So but the broad principle is there are contradictory ideas. Asti. Asti can refer to God is a person. God has personality. God has form. Nasti. God is not a person. God does not have a form. So contradictory ideas. Astiti, astiti, nastiti. So vastu nishthayor. Vastu, the substance, the object. Nishthayor. Nishthayor means according to one's nishtha. According to one's faith, one will perceive things differently. Some people will say asti, some people will say nasti. Ekasthayor. There is one substance. That is, there is one reality. It is situated in, one thing is situated. Bhinna viruddha dharmano. Bhinna is different, viruddha is opposite. So although there is one reality, different dharmas, different aspects, different natures of that reality may be perceived. To the extent that even opposite may be perceived. Ekasthayor bhinna viruddha dharmano. Of that one reality, different things may be perceived. Avekshitam kinchana yoga sankhyayo. And an example is given. Avekshitam. This will be known kinchana by some through yoga, by some through sankhya. So here, Vishwanath Chakra Thakur takes yoga to refer to bhakti yoga. And he uses sankhya to refer to the path of jnana. the path of bhakti and the path of jnana. So they will see, perceive differently. Samam param ya anukulam bruhat. Samam param. Actually, that is one absolute truth, the same absolute truth. Ya anukulam bruhat. But their people's consciousness is directed in different ways. That absolute truth is very big, and different aspects of that absolute truth may be highlighted. Anukulam bruhattat. So what this means is that the same absolute truth may be perceived as personal by the bhaktas and may be perceived as impersonal by the jnanis. And yet that absolute truth is the same one thing. It's one object which is perceived in different ways. Sometimes, so Prabhupada's purport is also very nice over here. The Prabhupada says there's sometimes a confrontation between personalists and impersonalists. But actually both personalists and impersonalists are trying to perceive the same absolute truth. And Prabhupada says actually even the theists and the atheists are also actually aiming for the same reality. Sometimes we may just judgmentally condemn the atheists, you know, atheists are. But even there are some people who may become atheists because of the bad image of religion that they have got. They may have seen hypocrisy in religion, they may have seen superstition in religion. They may have seen violence caused by in the name of religion, and that's why they have become atheists. But some atheists may also be intelligent people who may, because of their whatever they have been exposed to, they have thought that atheism is the most sensible explanation. But if they are also in a sincere spirit of inquiry, then eventually they will also grow. So what is stressed over here is that spirit of inquiry, that attempt to know the higher reality. But an attempt to know the higher reality, that is what is stressed over here. So, you know, Einstein is considered the greatest scientist of the last century. And he is actually used both by theists and by atheists. Atheists claim that he was an atheist, and theists claim that he was a theist. So actually how it is, from his scientific study, he felt that there is an intelligence manifested in nature. And he felt that there has to be some higher intelligence, and that he called as God. So he didn't believe in a God who is manifested through the orderliness of nature. But, so it says, this is the nature, this is the origin of his theistic statement, of his statement where he accepts God. But when he was presented the conception of God as revealed in the Abrahamic religions, but he felt this is a very parochial conception. This is a judgmental God who condemns sense people to hell. He couldn't accept that idea. So the magnificence of God as he understood through science, he couldn't reconcile with the conception of God that he got from the Christian teachers of his, from the Abrahamic teachers of his times. Now Christianity also has a subtle, sophisticated conception of God, but he was not exposed to that. So the point is that both appropriate him for their purposes. So he accepted God, but he did not accept the conception of God that he got from a particular tradition. So, I was making this point that even if he has made atheistic statements, he was a thinker and he observed nature and he tried to come through certain conclusions through nature. So, we don't have to judgmentally dismiss even atheists. What to speak of impersonalists? So, now, there is a difference between impersonalism and Mayavad. As we say, Brahmavad and Mayavad. So, impersonalism is a very integral part of the Vedic teachings. The Upanishads are filled with impersonalism. There is bhakti in the Upanishads also, but bhakti comes towards the conclusion. The primary message of the Upanishads is impersonal. And we should never condemn impersonalism. What is to be condemned? That will be mentioned in the next verse. That will be what is not right. But personalists and impersonalists both are approaching the same absolute truth. So some focus on his personal aspect, some focus on his impersonal aspect. And both are transcendentalists. Both are seeking a reality beyond this world. In that sense, both are great souls. So, they may not be Mahatmas in the sense of Bhakta. But we should not deride impersonalists. Because actually, they have been able to see beyond the gross illusions of Maya. They are looking for some reality beyond this world. And they have perceived one aspect of the absolute truth. So then, then he next states that, okay, if you say that that there are different people who have different opinions, is it that in the previous verse, the connection of the previous verse and this verse is that there are different people with different opinions and they are all, there's a diversity of opinions is because of illusion, such contradictions and
diversity of opinions is because of illusion. Then somebody may say, is it that then all philosophies are wrong and there is no reality only, everything is a product of illusion? Said no. When people are philosophically searching for the absolute truth, they are aiming for the same absolute truth, but they perceive different aspects of the absolute truth. And thus they get different understandings. So Bhaktivinoda Thakur in Chaitanya Shikshamrita states, it's a very elaborate section, I don't have time to go into that. But he says that, he gives the example that there is one mountain peak. You know, different people may pursue that mountain peak from different directions. And they may see some vegetation on one side, they may see some stone on the other side, they may see some soil on the other side, or they may see different kinds of trees on different sides. So he says that same one absolute truth is being pursued, but when it is pursued from different vantage points, different aspects of that absolute truth will be seen. Just like the mountain peak will be seen in differently from different directions. So he says Patanjali has seen that absolute truth from one direction, Plato has seen that absolute truth from another direction, from the east and the west, but it's one absolute truth that they pursue. So depending on the place from which we pursue, we will see it differently. So there's one absolute truth and that's what everyone is perceiving. But does that mean that, so here Brahmavad or impersonalism is accepted also as a valid realization. But in the next verse, the idea of the jiva being one with the absolute, that is countered. Yo anugrahartham bhajatam padamoolam anamarupo bhagavan anantaha namani rupani cha janma karma bhir Bhejesa mahyam parama prasidatu. So actually here they said, he's actually offering a prayer to the Lord. Prasidatu, may that Lord be pleased with me. Yo anugrahatam bhajatam padamulam. That Lord who gives mercy to those who worship His lotus feet. He is especially merciful to His devotees. Anamarupo bhagavan anantaha. So here again, in English it is called antithesis. Antithesis means two opposite ideas are brought together. So, anama rupo is said in one line and then nama nirupani janma karma bhir. That Lord, in His impersonal manifestation, He has no name, He has no forms. In His personal manifestation, He has no name, material name, no material forms. But when He comes in this material world, nama nirupani janma karma bhir. He manifests in this world, He appears and does activities and He acquires various names. He has manifests in various forms. Bheje samayam Paramaha prasidatu. Bheja means He manifests in this world, and that Lord who is transcendental, who is great, may He be merciful to me, may He be pleased with me. So from the previous verse we talked about the yoga and jnana, both are paths to approach the absolute truth. But here he is preferring the path of bhakti, the daksha. He is saying that Lord who is merciful to His devotees, who manifests as the avatars in this world and performs pastimes, may He be merciful to me. The whole idea of mercy is the idea of bhakti. Because in the impersonal manifestation, there is nobody to give mercy. So, He is clearly choosing the path of bhakti over here. Now, yah prakrite jnana pathai jnana, prakrite jnana pathai jnana. Yathashayam dehagato vibhati,
yathashayam dehagato vibhati.
Yathanila parthiva maashtrito gunam,
yathanila parthiva maashtrito gunam.
Sa ishvaro me kurutam manoratham,
sa ishvaro me kurutam manoratham.
Yah prakrita jnanapatha. So there is a jnanapatha and there is a prakrita jnanapatha. Prakrita jnanapatha means it is not the pure jnana marga. The pure jnana marga will help one to realize the impersonal aspect of the absolute truth. But the prakrita jnana patha, the impure jnana marga, that leads to the conception of oneness of the jiva with the absolute. Yathashayam deha gato vibhavati. So that in that one starts perceiving the Lord in different ways. So Prabhupada talks about how the demigods are also the manifestations of the absolute. But they are a lower level manifestation. They cannot take us to the absolute truth. They cannot take us to eternal destination. So, yathashayam deha gato vibhati, yathanilha parthivam ashrito gunam. So the example is given over here that there is wind, but wind, when it goes through different areas, whatever is the fragrance of that area, the wind acquires that fragrance. Similarly, that absolute truth, who is transcendental, depending on the consciousness of that people, he is perceived in different ways. So some may perceive him personally, some may perceive him as a devata, some may perceive him. There are people who may even make human beings into gods. They make human beings into God and they worship that human being as if it's God. So there are, what is happening? Based on their consciousness, they are perceiving things in a particular way. So their perception is not reality because they are not actually perceiving the absolute truth at all. So by the pure jnana marga, one perceives the absolute truth, pursues his personal aspect. But by the impure jnana marga, one comes with various misconceptions. So Ishvaro me kurutam manortham. That Ishvara, may he fulfill my desire. Kurutam manoratham. Manoratha is aspiration, desire. May he fulfill my desire. So after offering all these prayers which are primarily samprarthanatmika, he's glorifying the Lord. Then he expresses his personal desire, and with this he concludes. So this is the last verse of the Hamsa Guhya prayers, and afterward the chapter proceeds in terms of describing the events that happen over here. So if we go over the whole prayers now, what is happening in the prayers? First he says that this Lord is unknowable. Then he says, actually it's important to know him because he's very close to us. He's our friend. We close in emotion, position and disposition both. Then he says, why we can't know him? Because he's higher in the hierarchy than us. The hierarchy is described. And then how can he be known? When we become purified, then when the mind's obsession with matter stops, then the mind can pursue spiritual reality. And in terms of the flow as given by Chakravarti Pada, at that time one can pursue the impersonal aspect of the absolute truth. One starts perceiving spiritual reality, one starts perceiving the impersonal aspect. And then after that it is described that that Lord, he has this transcendental existence and he sustains his whole existence. Yes, my yari yato, we discussed that words. So he sustains everything, he exists beyond everything also. And that Lord, he is one Lord, one absolute truth, but he is pursued in different ways. And when people get too much into technicalities of philosophy, then they are actually coming under Atma Moham. They are being deluded by the Lord's energy. So he is to be known by the pure heart, but instead of cultivating purity of the heart, people just argue at the intellectual level, and they come up with different philosophies and they can't know the Lord. But does that mean if there are all different philosophies, does that mean that there is no absolute truth, everybody has just their own opinion and there is no ultimate reality? No, there is ultimate reality. And different people perceive it differently based on their nishtha, based on their level of faith, their level of consciousness, they perceive it differently. And there it's mentioned that the jnana and the yoga and sankhya, they pursue the bhakti, the bhakti marga, jnana marga, they pursue the personal and impersonal aspects of the absolute truth. And he says, I want to approach the person, and therefore he glorifies the path of bhakti and he says, my dear Lord, please have mercy on me. And he concludes that, yes, I want to pursue the Lord in this particular manifestation, but there are other different people, depending on their level of consciousness, they may conceive of different things as the absolute. And it is the Lord who reciprocates with them accordingly. So this is an overall prayer by which he pleases the Lord, and we'll see later that the Lord reveals himself to them by that. So I wanted to complete this section because this is one set of verses which is one unit of thought. And so I will not be, as I'm planning to come once a month, but I'll not be coming for the next 2 months because I'm going abroad. So I'll come back Krishnavaling on October 27th. So I doubt whether I'll be able to come in October. So probably I'll come in November. So I'm going to complete this flow of thought. So it is a little, I think, heavy. It's all this philosophy. But thank you for bearing with me. We have time for any one question? Oh, that's a long question. I think it's already 8:25. Can we discuss it next time? I think it's an important question. It will require time.
Small
question. Yes,
please. As far as universalism is concerned, there are certain organizations in the world which are teaching universalism. But probably it is not a bona fide organization. They are teaching according to their own religion. For example, just clearly speaking, Pramukh Mahavis. But what about
is this a small question? It's going to be a big question actually. Okay.
Just what is the destination of those people who are not following bona fide organization? Even if they are teaching
impersonalism. So if some organization is teaching impersonalism but they're not teaching bona fide properly according to scripture, what is the destination of people? So basically the destination is not determined by affiliation. Affiliation is any particular organization. Destination is determined by consciousness. So broadly speaking, there's sattvaguna, rajaguna, tamaguna. And there are, the dharma itself has various understandings. From the spiritual perspective, dharma is that which helps one to develop love of God. From the material perspective, dharma is that action which increases sattva and decreases rajas and tama. Sattva is basically order. Dharma is rajas expansion and tamas is destruction. So actually there is this Jaimini Sutra, just like the Vedanta Sutra, which begins with Athato Brahma Jigyasa. The Jaimini Sutra, which begins with Athato Dharma Jigyasa. And he gives many definitions of dharma over there. So one of the definitions of important definition of dharma is that which increases sattva. So if any way of living is enabling people to rise more towards goodness and decrease rajas and tamas, that is also dharma at one level. It may not be paradharma, but it is dharma at one level. So other organizations, if by following them, people are even learning some principles of piety, they are following some kind of regulation, they are getting elevated, that they are also following dharma at some level. Now where something is not exactly scriptural, that Krishna addresses in the 17th chapter. When Arjuna asks, Yashastravadim Utsrujya Vartate Shraddhayanita. Those do not have Shraddha, but not according to Shastra, what happens to them? And Krishna answers basically by analyzing things in terms of three modes. And he says, you look at their ahar, look at their yajna, look at their dana, look at their tapa. And then based on that, we can infer their destination. So the point of that verse is that we should, rather than just looking at the affiliation of people, we look at their lifestyle. We look at the kind of mode they are living in. And based on that, their destination will be. So if they are living sattvically to some extent, coming to goodness, that is good. And that is elevating them to some extent. So we don't have to, so whether they will attain Brahman liberation, that so they have to become actually purified of material attachments. Brahman liberation also is a very exalted state. And if they have material attachment, they will not attain that. It's not just a clear scriptural conception of Brahman that is required, but even purification is required. So there is Siddhanta and there is Achara. So there is Siddhanta and there is Sadachara. No? So sometimes, we condemn people because they don't have the right Siddhanta. But sometimes, condemn organizations which do not have the right Siddhanta. But those organizations may also be promoting Sadachara to some extent. So that way we can appreciate. Siddhanta is important, Sadachara is also important. Siddhanta should lead to transformation into Sadachara. So if some people are getting promoted in Sadachara by certain organizations, we appreciate that. So if they are not teaching the right Siddhanta, we can try to, if the people are receptive, give them the right Siddhanta. But we don't have to be dismissive towards anyone. If Sattvaguna is being elevated, Sattvaguna is being increasing people, if Sadachara is being created, we appreciate that. And if they don't have a proper Siddhantic understanding, not even of the personal aspect or even of the impersonal aspect, still there will be some elevation of consciousness that will happen. And liberation is a very lofty goal. That will not happen unless they are very pure than the purified material attachments. But some elevation will definitely happen. Okay? Thank you very much. So Granthraj Srimad Bhagavatam ki, Krishna Prabhupada ki, Bhaktavinoda ki, Tai Gaur Premanand. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna. Thank you.